Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it. Well, welcome back here to Circles of Change. It's not quite Halloween, and some of you are going to laugh when I make the following metaphor. I'd mentioned in our prior segment that I'm wearing bright red patent leather shoes, tied in with our guest about the red shoe movement. I'm also wearing a fabulous deep purple shawl, wearable art, from my next guest, because it just meant that much to me when my husband bought it for me and my daughter built an entire outfit around it for a wedding we were just in, my brother's, as a matter of fact. So no greater pleasure for me to welcome the creator of this gorgeous piece of art than Althea Bilodeau. Althea, how are you this morning?
I'm well, thank you, Zara. How are you?
Great. I know red shoes probably were not your design to go with the purple outfit, but it's absolutely spectacular. And in fact, at my brother's wedding, one of my nieces came up and said, you know, you're stealing the show from the bride with that outfit that you have.
Well, thank you.
So thank you. Let me introduce Althea and her work. She's a third generation fabric artist in fiber who expresses her love of fashion and color through textile creation and fashion design. Each of her one-of-a-kind garments and accessories are sculpted from her very own hand-dyed materials, including fine merino wool, silk, and other Vermont local and exotic natural fibers. From that classic outwear to striking scarves, shawl, and Zen bags, each of Althea's pieces really are carefully created in her home studio, where she employs an ancient non-woven fabric-making process that's called felting. She's a sixth of seven children raised on a self-sufficient farm in upstate New York. Her mother, Gloria Scannell, is a well-known weaver and spinner in the Albany area. So while surrounded by these fresh fleeces from her mother's prize-winning fiber sheep and her boiling dye pots filled with black walnut shells and oil skin, onion skins, Althea's natural color natural draw to color and fabric really was nurtured since she was a child. She's a young student of sewing and weaving. She pursued her interest in fashion through studies in costume design, construction, and modeling. In late 2009, this is a wonderful story, American fashion designer Chris Benz commissioned Althea to hand-dye some silk fabric for his fall 2010 collection. He then, in turn, created three stunning dresses and separates using her fabric. This collaboration was so successful that Althea's felt then was included in some blouse and jacket designs in his 2011 collection, and then showcased in 2012 in the resort collection with a jacket and coat made entirely of felt. The jacket is now on the racks at Saks Fifth Avenue in New York City, one of my favorite stores. So you entitled this segment, From the Farm to the Fashion World. Althea, did you ever think that this would be unfurling or weaving, however we would say it, felting, right in front of you?
Oh, I have to say no. But now when I look back, I see I've been sort of, you know, on this journey the whole time. Even when I was just a little girl, when my mother was raising these prize-winning sheep and spinning and dyeing, I actually wasn't very interested in the whole farming thing at that time. I was, you know, playing with my Barbies and exploring the little Barbie book full of little, you know, I didn't get to do much anything that, except that my mother did make all of our clothes when we were little. So I was exposed to sewing, but fashion wasn't really encouraged at the farm. So
well, that, and not just the farm, but where you lived in a fairly remote part of upstate New York.
Yeah.
And then your life taking you to a beautiful remote area of Vermont.
Yes, and Vermont is beautiful, and it used to be the biggest merino population in the world. We had merino sheep here. I mean, don't now, but it's just a beautiful mountainy area.
Well, Althea, I'm sure some people are thinking this idea of felt. They have these pictures of these felt squares that they buy at Michael's to cut
right.
and paste things in. And I would love for you, I don't know, because I'm sure I wouldn't do it justice, to describe the deep purple ruana, you call it, I believe, that I'm wearing right now, that it's actually very sheer, as well as some of those deeper felt touch areas.
Right. Okay, well, the felt squares that we all know and love are not natural fiber. So, but the real felt that is actually centuries old, like they have discovered felt from 6000 BC. And it's a non-woven fabric, so it doesn't require any spinning or weaving, so it doesn't require the tools. So, you know, back then they would actually, they believed that it started from a monk or someone walking with their sandals and their feet hurting and then plucking the wool off of the bushes where the sheep would rub up against and lose some of their wool and stuffing it in their sandals. And then with the pressure and the heat and the moisture from the ground, by the time they got to their destination, it had become a fabric in their sandals. And so the migratory folks who had animals and felt healthy made from natural fiber, they would take shear their animals and then fluff it up and put it in a neat pile on top of an old piece of felt or some other kind of, you know, like tarp or something, and then wet it, roll it up, and drag it behind their pack animals. Mm. And the pressure of bouncing behind the animal and create felt, and they would be able to use that felt to make the yurts, the sides of their tent. So anyway, I think the fact that it's primitive is the coolest thing, but the juxtaposition of the fact that we have this beautiful contemporary way of making felt is just the bomb.
That's exactly right. And then to include the felt within, at least your pieces, also within the weaving of silk.
Right. I'll just quickly explain how felt is made. A natural fiber, if you just run your finger down your own hair, it's silky in one direction, but if you go up the other direction, it's like it's what teasing is all about.
That's right.
There's scales that all point in the same direction. And when they're laid on top of each other, wetted, the moisture opens up the scales because it swells the fiber. And then the process of agitation rubs the fibers up against each other. And because it's slippery in one direction, it slides against each other, but then it can't come back because it's little like fish hooks.
Sure.
And so it slides and can't come back and slides and can't come back. And every time that happens, it gets tighter and tighter until it becomes a fabric, like a dreadlock. And the heat and the pressure, you know, create a nice, consistent fabric.
So
the silk that's in your Ruana is a woven fabric. And when in the process of putting the fiber on between under the woven fabric and doing that same process, those little natural fibers will wiggle their way through the weave of the fabric and then mat to each other. So it incorporates the fabric into the felt.
So for you as an artist to be able to use this truly multimedia that's both visually engaging as well as the texture and the touch.
Mm-hmm.
Experimentation from wools and silk and other exotic natural fibers.
It's endless.
It's endless. And then to also say, as I mentioned in the introduction, what someone might find bubbling in the pots in terms of how you get the colors of walnut shells, of onion skins, of flowers, you know, and natural plants.
Yeah. I have experience with the natural fiber, the natural dyes, but I actually choose to use chemical dyes. The mordant for chemical dyes is just citric acid. You can use that to can your fruit. And so it's not toxic. And the dye itself, as long as all of the dye is attached to the fabric, then there's really no toxin in the wastewater, which when you're using a natural dye, the mordants, which makes the natural dye stick, be more toxic. So
I do hope our listeners, as they're queuing in, we're speaking, by the way, with Althea Bilodeau. And so it's Althea Bilodeau.com. I feel we're speaking with half engineer, chemist, manufacturing specialist, chef, cook, creator. I mean, the idea you've got this blended set of skills and insights, many learned, like you say, from growing up on the farm, but also the tie into fashion and your following in that.
Yeah.
May I jump then to ask, how was it you first got connected with Chris Benz?
Yes. So I had been just a sewer. I had learned weaving from my mother, and I had my friend showed me a shawl that she had made in a felting workshop. And I was just floored. I just loved it. So I said to my mother, who had done felting like in the 70s, and it was all kind of thick, clunky kind of felt, I said, this thing called felt, have you heard of it? And she said, yeah, I have. And I said, I want to learn. So we decided to learn together. So we, I had been felting for about 6 years, and I juried into the Brandon Artist Guild in Central Vermont here, and as a felt artist. And in 2009, one of the members of Chris Benz stopped into the gallery and saw my felted scarves. And they connected with me. They called me. And
that's how we met, because that's from the guild. That's where
Brandon
we bought
Arts,
it
right.
at the Brandon Arts Guild.
Yeah,
we bought that.
But
how exciting to know that Chris included then your felt in some of his own designs, and then an entire entire garment to have it placed in New York City. Just wonderful.
Yes, yeah, it was a wonderful process, and it started. Well, they love the felt, but then they actually emailed me and said, there's this fabric that we can't get
mm-hmm.
from Paris. And Chris based his whole collection on it. And we know you dye the fabric for your felt. Do you think you could try to dye it? I don't know. I said, I'll try. So they sent me the fabric. And truth be told, I had only taken one dye class one day 5 years before that. But, you know, I figured, why not? I can try. I can look
Absolutely,
at it.
Absolutely, sure.
So I went and bought some silk charmeuse fabric and ripped it into 5 pieces and tried to figure out how that print was done
sure.
by trial and error and with what little I knew. And it was sort of like trying to decide what was in the soup. And
backwards, yep. Backwards engineering, yep.
Yeah, right. And the first couple of tries were not even close, but they were beautiful. So by the time I was done, I had these 5 pieces that were beautiful, and the last one was actually close to what they wanted. So I'll just never forget. I sent the whole lot of them down, and like within an hour after they opened it, they emailed me and said, oh my God, we love them all. And, you know.
It's also a testimony as an artist or a creator that while you might be intentionally trying to get from A to Z, that journey along the way of things that, quote, might be viewed as mistakes might actually will be where some
exactly.
of your best work are.
Yes, and what I've told them before is that they've stretched me as an artist because
Lovely,
basically
yes.
everything that they asked me to do I had never really done before. And so, I mean, what's better than that?
It is, and I think any of our listeners who are in the fine arts or the performing arts as well, or actually anyone in the problem-solving world, there's nothing like a good challenge like that
yeah, exactly.
to bring the best of us. But also it sounds like, if I might suspect, based on the words you've chosen here, you've surprised yourself.
Yes, exactly. And like you pointed out earlier, you said it's sort of this engineering and this arty thing. There is an engineering gene in our family, and I have a little bit of it, because one of the things that I loved was figuring out how do I dye 6 yards of silk charmeuse
yeah.
in tie-dye. You know, how do you do that?
Right.
And I had this contraption set up on my 4 banquet tables that looked like the game Mousetrap from when we were kids.
Oh, yes.
You know,
yeah.
The little thing would go tick, tick, tick up this way and then down this way and then would go into the dye there and then it would be tied up in this and it would go up and down. It was actually kind of fun.
Well, and again, that's also the joy that you've got in your craft and also as you've evolved it into the business world.
Yes.
Well, I know, Althea, that we've had quite a list here of quite a few exhibitions that you've had the opportunity to participate in there in Rutland, Vermont, in Brandon, in New York, in Glen Falls, smaller areas, larger cities.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us any standout experiences of having the chance to exhibit in one of those. What does it feel like as an artist working right out in the public?
Yeah, it's it makes you vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's what we do whenever we put ourselves out there. But it's also wonderful. And part of most of those are with my group, the Northeast Feltmakers Guild.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a website if anybody wants to look at it, northeastfeltmakersguild.com. And we are feltmakers from Maine to Pennsylvania, New Jersey. There's 100 of us. And we meet 3 times a year and we get together and do exhibitions together, and it's been educational for folks who come to these shows, and it's been fun to grow as a group.
Well, what I also suspect is that you all are, just like our previous guest, you're involved in a movement of establishing felt making as a core part in the fabric art world.
Yes.
Right? I mean, you mentioned the ancient nature of it, but that doesn't mean it's necessarily been understood, embraced, taught, tools developed for it, special equipment designed.
Right.
And so who knows, that engineer in your background might realize that what you've got sitting on your banquet tables there could turn into a system that could enable others.
That would be great.
Well, that's what others. Have you gotten it patented? Is it copyrighted?
Not yet.
Not yet. That's the whole side of me.
Right. Yeah, I am going to be producing coats, which means I'm going to be needing to make bigger pieces. And, you know, every time, that's just another challenge. You know, making shawls is one thing, but making yardage of coat weight. I mean, I did some for Chris Benz, but to really be producing and putting them out there. Taylor Thomas owns Parlor Showroom, and she would like to carry a line of my coats. So, and she actually supports emerging designers in allowing them to have a space in New York City where, for designers who can't really afford their own showroom. And so if, you know, their coats are there and boutiques say, yeah, we want them, then somehow I'm going to have to be able to produce all that felt, which of course, you know, I will, because I love a challenge. But yeah, there's got to be a way to do it, and not have, it can't be all mechanized. There's
way. Well, and it's like you say, it's the, particularly because we're looking at this as wearable art in many regards.
Right.
The other side is just hearing your story then about this idea that there's going to be, that there is room for almost mass customization, both of the fabrics and then the items you make. That certainly seems antithetical to our thought that someone is in Manhattan or the design studios at the various, you know, Rhode Island School of Design or Savannah College of Art and Design, where our son goes, and that things go transfer over the wire to China, or it's then converted into XYZ, and then 2 weeks later, bingo, it's in some of the big name boutiques. So the idea, though, that you as an artist can still partner from start to finish to the point of knowing perhaps the customers, like me, who's invested in a piece of your work, there's got to be room for all of that in the fashion industry.
I think so. And my perception of the fashion world is that, and maybe it's always been this way and it's just because I'm, you know, focusing on it, but it seems to be embracing new textiles, and that is something to make the fashion new. You know, I don't know. I watched Project Runway. Yes, I do. I watch it. I love it.
We
actually
do as well, yes.
And there was a gal who made her own textiles, and she made it all the way to the finals. And I think it was because it was so cool that she could make her own textiles, and that was unique and desired by folks who want something new and unique.
And that's happening in the book world with people making their own paper.
Yeah.
Absolutely, paper.
Yes, right.
The different covers and jackets, let alone, of course, embedding technology so the books now have, you know, QR codes that you can talk and they can talk to you at the same time.
Right.
But still coming back to that whole end-to-end. You know, back to the whole idea, though, this really soft, fine wool that you use and the silk fabric. You know, people might view that on the, you know, the mannequins or the you know, display at these various boutiques, that it's very, very fragile.
Yeah.
But actually, it's extremely durable.
Exactly.
And, oh, by the way, my piece I wore on the top of a river paddle boat in Washington, D.C., and it was very cold, if not cold, frigid out. And I was warm in this that otherwise looked like I was wearing a very light see-through scarf.
Right. Silk is an incredible, I mean, incredible fabric. It is so strong. The, like, pound per square inch of actual silk fibers is like as strong as steel. And, of course, you know, if it's really loosely woven, it's more fragile than if it's tightly woven. But it's fabulous, fabulous. Of course, the merino wool is the finest of the wool breeds. And it felt easier because it's fine and because it has crimp and it has, the scales are really tiny and close together. But it's really soft. I mean, it is next to your skin, wonderful cashmere,
right.
Almost.
Absolutely, really, and it's very striking. It would steal a part of the eyes from the bride, I will admit. I know, I had to lay low with that. But, you know, Althea, we said third generation. So,
okay, yeah.
So tell us about the two prior generations. Of course, your mom is an octogenarian, I know, and just enjoying, I'm sure, thoroughly. Hi, Mom, listening in as well.
Yeah.
But the idea of from generation to generation, what does that feel like? And you're passing it to your children, I understand, too.
I am, yeah. It's really fascinating, actually, because my grandmother, her name was Althea, and actually her mother was Althea also. Mm-hmm. And my mother is Gloria. So great-grandmother Althea, my mother was born in 1925, so, you know, it was
right.
In 1800s. They did a lot of handwork at home, the women. And so she loved it and I still have some of the pieces that she made. But my grandmother, Althea, lived in Brooklyn, and her father was, my grandfather, Lusher, played in the John Philip Sousa band. And so when he played in this country, she got to go to, you know, into the city and go see the concerts with my great-grandmother. And so she would make her own fashions to wear to these events. And so I have a couple of pieces that she made, but one of the stories I know is that she would go into Fifth Avenue and look in the windows and then go home and recreate.
Mm-hmm.
Even the hats, she would recreate them. So she had, you know, this talent. And then my mother was born in 1925, and it was cesarean section, and it was her second one. And unfortunately, she didn't survive the surgery. She died when my mother was 9 days old. So my mother inherited this, but she didn't get it straight from my mother. My grandmother,
right.
She didn't teach my mother these things, but my mother had a burning desire to know how to do it. And she found somebody to help teach her tatting when she was little, and crocheting and knitting and rug braiding and then weaving. So I think that in itself is fascinating. It's just in us.
Yes, it's one of those things you can't run from. It's going to come back in some way, somehow. And the same way you said your son is interested in the business you've been involved.
He's felting with me now, which is actually a good thing, because felt, especially heavy felt, thick felt, is immensely heavy when it's soaking wet. A giant piece of felt to make a coat is really heavy. And part of the process is needing to roll and then throw and fold. The folding process is the shrinking. So once the fibers are felted, you have to shrink them down and actually heat it up and change the protein of the fiber so that it mats into this never coming apart fiber. I mean, it is solid state. You can cut it, no fraying, no nothing coming off. It's this really lasts forever kind of fabric.
That's
but
right.
It takes some muscle. And
it's
so
muscle.
My son's helping me with that part, which is awesome.
That's
Everybody
right.
needs someone to throw that felt for them.
Well, that's right. Well, that tells us that your business also has got a built-in wellness plan for you as the artist to keep you going. Althea, you mentioned, of course, like you said, your grandmother, your great-grandmother, your mother's impressions on you. Other influencers on your artistic ability. I mean, do you see your designs in the landscape? Do you see it in paintings? I mean, where do you think those insights are coming that you manifest then in your artwork?
Yeah, I'm actually inspired by looking at fashion and all of mostly the really eccentric looking shapes and forms, and the color as well. But color comes to me from nature. I mean, this fall I've been surrounded by my favorite colors, which are the autumn leaves, and it's beautiful here in Vermont. And so I would say for sure that I love the elements, the earth elements, you know, wind, fire, air, earth, and how they come together, and actually how they are separate from each other. And I have, when I first got going making things for the Brandon Artist Guild, I was inspired to make my first bag, and I took a workshop from somebody who knew how to construct the bags, which was awesome. And before I went, I asked a friend of mine, his name is Pete Sherritt, to make a wooden buckle because he did wood turning.
Mm-hmm.
And he made this beautiful wooden buckle, and I brought it with me, along with a designer scarf, to this workshop. And I ended up felting the designer's part of it into the bag, and lined the bag with the rest of this vintage scarf and made a belt for the bag and put the buckle on it. And it was the birth of this whole new thing for me, which was bag making. And I loved them, and people loved them. And
You see how you can integrate all those different pieces and also rely on the work of others. Well, Althea, again, our guest has been Althea Bilodeau. It's A-L-T-H-E-A. And then the last name, BILODEAU.com. And I love the closing comment on your flyer that Ted tucked in this beautiful deep purple Rana that I'm wearing. It says, the Althea Bilodeau collection is a reflection of my colorful upbringing and unique ability to transform these influences into the stylish ease of a carefree attitude.
Mm.
And I like that attitude. Thank you so much for joining us here on Circles of Change.
You.
And we're going to watch your work evolve and change. Thank you so much, Althea.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks so much.
Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll-free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, helping others unleash potential through transformational change. 1-877-544-2580.